Our presentation this morning is entitled Rolling the Dice, God, Climate Change, and Saskatchewan. Our presenter is Richard Jacks, a member of this fellowship. Richard was born in Sacramento. Wishing I was there. Richard was born in Southampton, Ontario, the son of Dr. Harry Jack and Jenny Jack. In childhood, Richard attended Unitarian churches in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Lexington, Kentucky. After moving to Regina in 1962, the family attended the fellowship in the YMCA. And after high school, Richard moved to Calgary and lived with his sister Marge. Returning to Regina to look after his ill father, Richard found employment in Saskatchewan Health for about 35 years, finally ending his career at eHealth for about three years. And during that period, Richard held virtually every position in this fellowship and also was a lay chaplain for many years. He's currently on the board and chair of the chaplaincy committee. Richard also helped found the Regina Multi-Faith Forum. With the birth of Thomas and Arthur, Richard became active in disabled groups. Sadly, Thomas passed away at age 17 from complications of cerebral palsy. And after retirement, Richard has become active again in the fellowship and is currently the deputy leader of the Saskatchewan Green Party. So he's a busy fellow. Over to you, Richard.
Wayne, I'll begin this presentation today by presenting a wide variety of books on climate change from a large variety of the social sciences. Virtually 99% of social sciences agree that continuing to leave a human footprint of double what is sustainable is the greatest crisis that humankind has faced since the last ice age 12,000 years ago. The last time carbon dioxide levels were this high was 6.75 million years ago, which interestingly was the extinction of the dinosaurs, in part due to an asteroid which altered the climate very rapidly. And also 60,000 years ago, when an extended drought in southern Europe led to the disappearance of Neanderthal man, which is a warning for all of us. At 411 parts per million in the atmosphere this February, carbon dioxide is headed for the highest levels ever recorded, having doubled in 200 years since the beginning of the Industrial Age. In China, levels in the major cities have reached as high as 900 parts per million, and they contribute to approximately 6 million deaths a year from the poisoning of the atmosphere. Regardless of what measures we take today, we have already guaranteed our future generations a world facing the greatest, gravest challenges humankind has ever faced. We are facing the sixth major extinction in the life of the earth. Theologians have long dealt with issues of creation and wonder of all living things. I will use a sample of Christian views. Virtually every faith has something to say about this. But as Christianity has dominated most of the industrialized nations in the earth, I choose to use it as my example. The book I am reading from is called A New Climate for Theology from Sally McFaig. Sally McFaig was a theologian for 30 years at Vanderbilt University in the United States. And after retiring, she became a guest professor at the Vancouver School of Theology. And fortunately, Jamie had an opportunity to be there recently. She draws much of her theological thought from people like Richard and Ricardo Niebuhr and John Cobb. I am starting my readings with the biblical reading from Isaiah chapter 65, 17 to 25. For I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating. For I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard in it, or the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain, or bear children for calamity, for they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, but they shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. Now we could all aspire to a world like that. That is a biblical reading. A more modern view, enunciated by Sally McFaig, says, it is with the acceptance of the continuum of life that empathy develops. The saint's growing sense of universal love, love for all without exception, is not a momentary or mysterious insight. Rather, it develops in tandem with the loving God. It is an extension of seeing God everywhere. As Woolman notes, one can't find God without loving all that God has made. The continuum of life is a reflection of the oneness of creation. We are all called by God's love to universal love for all, a possibility that is based on the interdependence of all life. Hence, profound empathy with all forms of life is not a romantic fantasy. Rather, it is based on the empirical evidence that we are all interconnected and interdependent. Another view is, if we accept this picture of interrelationship and interdependence, the picture that puts us on a continuum with all other creatures, and that claims that the whole can be healthy only if the parts are fed, then we have a very different understanding of ourselves than the one that is depicted in our consumer culture and its consequences, climate change. That culture basically says that each of us human individuals now has the right to all we can legally acquire. In fact, we owe it to ourselves to have the very best. Once again, the saints have a very different view. In his Christmas sermon of 1967, Martin Luther King wrote, "As nations and individuals, we are interdependent, all caught up in the inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of human destiny." The model of God that has God and the world as God's body is appropriate for our time. It understands the doctrine of creation to be not primarily about God's power, but about God's love. How we can live together, all of us, within for God's body. It focuses attention on the near, on the neighbor, on the earth, on meeting God not later in heaven, but here and now. We meet God in the world, and especially in the flesh of the world, in feeding the hungry, healing the sick, and in reducing greenhouse gases. An incarnational understanding of creation says nothing is too lowly, too physical, too mean a labor if it helps creation to flourish. We find God in caring for the garden, in loving the earth well. This becomes our vocation, our central task. Climate change then becomes a major religious, if not the major Christian issue of our time. To be a Christian in our time, one must respond to the consequences of global warming. In Genesis, God tells Adam and Eve not only to care for the garden, but also how good it is. After each act of creation in the first chapter of Genesis, God saw that it was good. After completing the entire creation, God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was good. Genesis 1, chapter 31. Interestingly, God does not say it is good only for human beings or even good for meat. God, but simply good. This is an ascetic response expressing appreciation for the intrinsic value of each and every creature, plant, and planetary process, sun, moon, earth, water. And I have a number of other readings, but I'd like to move on at this point to some presentations from probably one of the most important books that has been written in modern times, called The Climate Casino by William Nordhaus. He shared the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2018 with Paul Romer for his work on climate change. Many of the things that are documented in this book involve the research of hundreds of social scientists, economists, and it has become literally necessary reading for anyone interested in climate change. Some of the important findings: current concentrations of carbon dioxide far exceed the levels observed for at least 650,000 years. The best estimate of global temperature increase from 1900 to today is between 1.8 and 4 degrees Celsius. The range of estimates for sea level rise over the 21st century is between 7 and 23 inches, depending upon the scenario, but excluding the effects of the large ice sheets. And I must note that the melting of the permafrost in the Greenland ice sheet is particularly dangerous, as it contains very large amounts of methane. Temperatures are expected to rise more rapidly over land and much more rapidly in the Arctic than the global average temperature rise, up to 13 degrees average in the Arctic. The Arctic Ocean is expected to be ice-free during the summer by the end of the 21st century, and it might occur even sooner. The intensity of hurricanes expected to increase, and many other bad effects of the rise of temperature and carbon dioxide. Now, we must ask, which systems are currently manageable and which are currently have already reached the tipping point and are going to be very difficult to manage anytime in the near future? Some of the unmanageable systems are the ocean acidification, which has resulted in the death of most of the coral reefs in the ocean. For example, the Great Barrier Reef is now only half of what it was a generation ago. The death of wildlife, I'll talk about that a little later. The sea level rise, a minimum of 2 meters up to 5 meters by the 21st century. William Nordhaus gives a scenario about 1 in 3 where the worst case would occur. There's a book which largely follows that, called The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells, which some people would call alarmist, but certainly needs to be noted if one is going to look at possible scenarios. Systems that could be managed are most economic sectors, things like manufacturing and healthcare, and most human activities like sleeping, surfing the internet, etc. We do have a chance, if we were to act now, of certainly mitigating the effects. There are three basic ways where we as humans could change our future. One is adaption, and that is a good way of doing it. It's like going to the electric car, those sort of things. But the problem is it takes too long. We don't have that long. The other second one would be geoengineering, which could work, but once you start, you can't end it, like in ejecting things into the atmosphere, and it's terribly dangerous, and its side effects could be a major reduction in crop production, etc., by lowering the temperature. And the third way is by mitigation, and this is the way that is best to do it. Things like William Nordhaus says, you can see why economists emphasize the many advantages of using carbon prices to reduce carbon emissions. They provide strong incentives to reduce emissions, change behaviors. They do so in an even-handed way. They affect all aspects of the economy, from production to innovation, and they economize on the information that people need to make efficient decisions. Now, some of the partially managed systems that we need to attack right away are economic sectors like agriculture and forestry. We could plant crops that use more CO2. We could find ways of using less water and other things in our ecosystem. And there are also some things we can manage, like non-market systems, beaches and coastal ecosystems, and wildfires. For every degree of temperature that rises, there's approximately a fourfold increase in wildfires. So if temperatures rise 5 degrees by the next century, you can see what is considered normal now would not be considered normal then. Our forests, which traditionally were somewhat of a carbon sink, with forest fires and insect infestation like the pine beetle in BC, and that there has been far more decomposition, and in fact are a net negative now in the carbon equation. At the International Panel for Climate Change, 4th assessment looked at dangerous results that are likely to occur at different temperature thresholds. Here's a summary of some of the impacts. At 1 degree, increased water shortages, increased coral bleaching, increased coastal flooding, increasing amphibian extinctions. Excuse me. At 2 degrees, in addition to the above, about 20 to 30% of species are at high risk of extinctions, increasing burden of diseases. That's about where we are right now. At 3 degrees, in addition to the above, decrease in productivity of food crops, long-term commitment to several meters of sea level rise due to melting ice sheets, substantial burden on health systems. At 5 degrees, in addition to the above, major extinctions around the globe, major decreases in food productivity, 30% plus loss in coastal wetlands, major coastal flooding and inundation, reconfiguring of the world's coastlines, major change in ocean circulation. And at the rate we're going right now, the last scenario seems to be where we're headed. In Saskatchewan today, I feel like a little like a mouse in a land of dinosaurs. Fortunately, the dinosaurs became extinct. So interestingly, the last era that the earth was ice-free was the heyday of the dinosaurs a million years ago. The oceans were several hundred feet above what they are today. In the 1400s, oceans were considerably lower than what we see today. This is why some conclude, despite all the evidence, that climate change is a hoax. There are really three kinds of deniers. The first kind are those who refuse to recognize the information that is out there. They rely on false information, both for and against climate change on social media, and they need to spend more time reading the latest information from the top Nobel Prize-winning scientists in many different fields. This ignores the evidence that we have taken from atmospheric measurements of CO2, methane, and other greenhouse gases. The second group of deniers I will talk about is that people recognize that there is climate change, but they dispute the models. And certainly if you have 100 models, you're going to find some that are contrarian. And that, in fact, is a legitimate view, and it has forced the rest of us to do more research into climate change. And how we've done that are atmospheric measurements of CO2, methane measurements, measurements of other greenhouse gases. We use tree ring records, soil cores, ice cores, and other measurements like ocean temperatures to project into the future based on past experiences. In most cases, climate scientists agree on the methodology being used. Now, not all climate inputs are manageable by humans, and this can certainly lead to variables, especially with the unmanageable inputs. All human activity can affect the amount of greenhouse gases, and often they are called externalities, as they have no cost to the business in spite of being a direct result of the activity. We are causing irreversible damages to the ecosystems of the Earth currently. The temperature goal of the Paris Accord was to limit the increase to plus 2 degrees Celsius by 2030. The International Panel on Climate Change suggested a more stringent goal of plus 1.5 degrees Celsius, as we may well reach an irreversible tipping point due to cumulative effects. To achieve either goal, all countries would have to participate in carbon mitigation. Saskatchewan has the highest carbon dioxide emissions per person in Canada. The current situation in Canada is that the two major fossil fuel provinces of Alberta and Saskatchewan are preventing Canada from reaching its international obligations under the Paris Accord. Without American participation, there is little likelihood of meeting those goals. Indeed, no major industrial country has ever met the goals of the Kyoto or Paris Accord. Politicians will sign on to these agreements, not being willing to take the actions which could reduce the GDP of their countries by up to a third by 2100. I'm talking about the growth of GDP, not our current level, but the potential growth could be reduced by up to a third by 2100. But failure to act would result in a loss of GDP up to 50%. And that is a number of these books I have here have talked about that. Certainly the consequence of melting the glaciers in polar ice caps, the thawing of the permafrost, acidification of the oceans, loss of up to 80% of sea mammals and 40% of land animals, that's from the World Wildlife Fund research, changes to ecosystems and rising health dangers, heat stroke in many parts of the world will make those countries unlivable, hurricanes, extended droughts. These changes will occur rapidly in future decades compared to the millennia that natural changes have occurred in the past. A real question we must ask is how much biodiversity will survive such rapid change? 5 major extinctions have occurred in the past. We are entering the 6th such major extinction and the most rapid. Saskatchewan will see the end of glacial melt in hotter, drier summers. There will be extreme variability in weather from year to year, with greater risk of extended drought conditions. And I note, potash is the largest industrial user of water in Saskatchewan. The effect of the cost and availability of water is sure to be affected. The number of summer days of over 30 degrees Celsius will grow from the current average of approximately 4 summer days a year to over 20. In many countries, heat stroke will become a regular occurrence. One possible benefit of this could be to add to the largest solar and wind capacity in Canada that Saskatchewan enjoys. Saskatchewan has large biofuel reserves in northern Saskatchewan, but they could be very negatively affected by more fires, warmer temperatures, and poor growth of trees and plants. And I note that higher CO2 actually results initially in more growth of crops, particularly weeds will grow, they become thicker and grow faster, but over time higher temperatures will limit the growth of particularly grain crops, things like our cereal crops and corn. We have made virtually little or no progress in weaning Saskatchewan from fossil fuels. We have built a carbon capture facility, one of 18 in the world, But in order for that to be effective, we would have to build one of these plants every day from now to 2100. And the cost of doing such a thing is simply astronomical. We have many options to mitigate climate change, but by far the cheapest and most effective way to lower GHG is the carbon levy.
Richard, can you wrap it up a bit?
Yeah.
Thanks.
There is an old English proverb, the best way to roll the dice is to throw the dice away. Saskatchewan must begin its transition to sustainable economy and ecosystem today, regardless of the self-interest of many existing corporations, the fossil fuel companies, and unions. Unions like the energy, chemical workers, Teamsters, and steel workers. We need to look ahead to the world our grandchildren will inherit. Thank you.